Hello, here's the download of Broadcasting House from the 10th of February. I'm Paddy O'Connell. On today's programme, care costs in England, digging in a car park to find what's beneath our feet, and talk of garden gnomes. Just a reminder, please don't enter the quiz. Thanks for clicking, and here we go. BBC Radio 4. It's 9 o'clock. Good morning. This is Broadcasting House. Hello, I'm Paddy O'Connell with the headlines. More people are to pay inheritance tax to help meet the costs of care for the elderly in England. A fox has attacked a baby at his home in London, and Barclays is closing its unit, which helps people avoid tax. Before 10, amid the Chris Hughne case, we hear from one father about the pain of estrangement from a child.
You know, I knew he was in a difficult place, and the best I could do is be patient and be there for him when things changed, if they changed. But I always hoped they would.
Ahead of tomorrow's anniversary of Sylvia Plath's death, we reflect on her work during the last winter of her life and hear from her herself.
Oh, my God, what am I, that these late mouths should cry open in a forest of frost, in a dawn of cornflowers.
And we're on an archaeological dig in a car park, but not that one.
Every day's an adventure and a puzzle to work out, you know. You never know what you're going to find. You know, maybe a king, maybe a bit of pot or an old bit of wood. You never know. To us, it's all exciting.
But enough about loose ends. Now, reviewing the papers, the art supremo Charles Swarmerus Smith, railway buff Michael Portillo and Heather Bell back tonight as Clary Grundy in The Archers. Welcome along to Sunday morning on Radio 4. We'll begin with the top news story. The cost of funding care for the elderly is back in the news this morning. It's a dilemma across the UK, as you and your extended family can no doubt tell us. Well, currently, people in England with savings and capital of more than £23,250 have to pay for unlimited care costs. The political problem has long been how to address this. Well, the government looks set to announce tomorrow that it will freeze inheritance tax thresholds at £325,000 for individuals and £650,000 for couples. The latest detail suggests that a new cap on care costs could be introduced of £75,000, which would allow more people to qualify for some free state care. We woke up Paul Lewis, the presenter of Radio 4's Moneybox, normally on a day off, and asked him to explain these proposed changes.
People are afraid that they may have to use the value of their home to pay for their care. Now, my view is I don't see why they shouldn't, to be honest, because they've got the home, they've put value into it, and when they need that in later life, why shouldn't they use it? It's not they who'll benefit from it, it's their children.
A sort of equity release for care.
Yes, absolutely. But people are very concerned about that. They think, I've saved up all my life and I don't want this money to be spent on care that should be provided free by the state. And there's, you know, a lot of people believe it should be provided by the NHS, and in some cases it is. So what the government's done is to say two things, really. First of all, once you've spent a certain amount on care, you will have to spend no more. But that isn't as simple as it sounds.
No, hang on then. It's £75,000 in England as a likely cap. And you're telling me that's not actually the extent of your outgoings?
No, it certainly isn't, because what you have to do is buy £75,000 worth of care at the rate a local authority would pay for it. Now, local authorities don't pay as much as you or I would pay. So to buy what will be about 200 weeks of care, 4 years, it will cost you or I a lot more than it would cost a local authority. So I reckon you'd probably have to spend closer to £100,000 to buy 200 weeks of care. And that's just the care bit. You are also going to have to pay what they call your hotel costs, your bed, your breakfast, your meals, that kind of thing. So it's by no means an open cheque on the government. And of course, that's the idea. They don't want to spend a limitless amount on it.
So what's the net effect, do you think, on people of this? It's quite complicated. Is it going to be more of a bill or less of a bill?
Well, people who get it free anyway through local councils, and that's the majority of people, will see no difference. The people who will gain are the ones who own a home, who are afraid that the value of that home might be taken to pay for their care. And if they stay in a care home for a long time, less of that value will be taken. And that really is the bottom line. So, and if you look at the Dilnot report, which this is based on, that was published in 2011, the people who gained the most were the people who had the most. Now, one slight change which may ameliorate that is that when you are paying for your care before you reach the cap, you will be able to keep a bit more of your money. So if you've got savings up to 120,000-odd, you'll have to pay a contribution, but at the moment you have to pay all your care bill if you have savings of over £23,000-odd. So in future you'll get a contribution at a lower level, and that will help some people who have less, whereas the big change, the cap, will tend to benefit those who have the most.
Well, our thanks to Paul Lewis. I can tell you, you will be hearing more about this over the next 24 hours. It's one of those Radio 4 stories previewing a government announcement, so there's going to be plenty of time to try and understand the detail. But thanks to Paul on his day off on giving us a start. It's 9:10. We'll look back at the week's news a little bit. It was revealed that David Beckham's latest campaign to flog undercrackers also featured a body double. The new US Secretary of State, John Kerry, refused to show off his French at a maiden news conference he gave, but this news report made it here as the Sunday morning quiz.
Amphibians, and like all such creatures, they're cold-blooded with moist skins like a frog.
I will do everything I can in debating and then defeating Barack Obama. Thank you. Good luck and God bless you.
Well, there are terms and conditions for this, if you can be bothered with it, on the website. Please don't enter after the press review. On email all week, 24 hours, we're bh@bbc.co.uk for all your comments, suggestions and one-liners. It's 9:11. A string of text messages sent between father and son has been made public in the Chris Huhne case. The private exchange, showing the son's anger and estrangement, led some commentators to question if we should ever have been allowed to see them. We sought the account of another father estranged from his son and his daughter. He wants a relationship again with both, but we asked him to talk about his son.
There was no falling out, there was no real change. And suddenly I got no responses to emails, texts, wouldn't answer the phone. Contact stopped. I was told that he didn't want to see me. And so I was left wondering what on earth was going on.
What does that mean, to be left wondering what's going on?
Oh, it's terrible. It's terrible. It's you don't really know where to turn. And it I don't think it took over my life, but it took over quite a bit of it.
Did it feel like a bereavement?
Oh, absolutely, yes. It's like a bereavement where, you know, where they haven't found the body. You know, that you don't know whether really it's happened or not, or whether you need to keep looking. And often I'd feel very cross. I'd try and put myself in his place a lot of the time and think, well, you know, what's going on here? I couldn't come up with any answers. So I just went round in circles.
Now, we know that you have got contact. But how did it begin, and after how much time?
It was about 6 years before anything happened.
6 years?
Yeah. And that included visiting school and seeing him play football and rugby and so on, and being completely ignored. You know, it was so hard to understand. And
You stood on the touchline and were ignored?
Absolutely. Completely. Even went up to him once and he just turned the other way and walked away. It's quite extraordinary, and I guess he's probably listening to this, and I hope he doesn't feel I'm cross with him about it. It was obviously upsetting at the time, but I knew he was in a difficult place, and the best I could do is be patient and be there for him when things changed, if they changed. But I always hoped they would.
So why did they change, and when?
Well, not long ago. I don't know why. What happened was curious, really. It was my birthday, and I decided to phone him up. It rang for a bit, and then I got the voicemail. And I said something like, hi, this is Dad. It's my birthday, as you probably know, and I just thought I'd give you a call and you know, on the off chance he wanted to wish me happy birthday. And just left it at that.
Quite brave of you.
Well, yeah, I hadn't done that before. I didn't normally try phoning, but I thought, what the hell? And 10 minutes later, I get a text back saying, happy birthday, Dad, with an X after it. I tell you, that X was just, you know, after all that time, it was a huge moment, really. I sent further texts and we agreed to we'd have a conversation at some point, and we did, and that was great. A tiny bit strained in some ways, but not really. We both managed to kind of laugh about it.
And you said, if he's listening, it's important that there's not blame in what you're saying.
Mm.
And is that known? Does he know that? Have you found a new way to communicate that is in the present and not in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, having met with him, one of the more striking parts of it was to feel that there wasn't this parental thing anymore, because he's an adult and we were just two adults doing stuff together, and there was no sort of duty element from him or any parental element from me. It was just so open and different. You know, something has changed for him. I don't know what it is. He's a free agent, and I'm glad he's using his freedom in what I would consider a wise way.
And in your whole life, how important is this reconciliation?
Oh, hugely, hugely. It's a huge weight off my shoulders. I can get on with it, really, now. I'm hoping the same will happen for his sister, and that's kind of on the way.
Well, that's one perspective of the father there, following separation of two parents, on what happens within one family. It's exactly 17 minutes past nine. Coming up in the programme, we're going to give voice to Richard III, and first, we're going to give praise to those who dug him up. The discovery of the last Plantagenet king has given a boost to archaeologists and a whole new way of looking at car parks. We'll talk about that in a moment. First, picture the scene in Bristol by the harbour side. There's a dig on in the drizzle and a gaggle of schoolchildren agog. They've stumbled on the scene on their way to their minibus and found out what's beneath their feet.
We are St. Teresa's Catholic Primary School, and we are spending the day exploring Bristol by foot, and we met a real archaeologist, and it's been very exciting and very informative.
Are you excited to see an archaeologist?
Yeah!
So I've chanced upon fans of archaeology aged about seven?
Ten.
Ten. Oh, you're nine and ten. All right, you're nine. They're fans of archaeology, and they, like me, have come to meet Tim Longman, who is running this dig in the centre of Bristol. Tim and his team from Bristol and Region Archaeological Services are unearthing the history of shipbuilding. The school party beckons him over for a photo, and it's an unscripted moment of the kind radio reporters live for. These children are the living, breathing proof that digging with a tiny trowel has got the X factor, and Richard III has helped.
Big smile for archaeologists.
Yeah! 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 I really enjoyed that. That was fun.
What exactly are you looking for?
Evidence of the shipbuilding, evidence of the different activities that were taking place here.
What era, can I ask, are you looking at?
Everything from, really, from the late 17th century, so the late 1600s, through to the around about 1900.
How long do you think it will take to build the shop?
Do you know why this car park was called the Wapping Wharf?
Did you have to...
They're full of questions after a history tour with their teacher, Elaine Bailey, who spotted the search for the story of shipbuilding bang next to the school minibus.
That's all right.
Thank you!
Now, Tim, it goes without saying, we're in a car park.
Yes, essentially.
And as we know from Richard III, car parks is where it all happens.
It seems to be the case, yes. Dig in a car park and you'll find some archaeology by the sound of it.
So who do we see here with this trowel?
This is a colleague of mine, Martin.
Now, Martin, I feel I have to say cobbles.
Yes, cobbles.
Just trying to clean them up, get them all nice and shiny for the photos, pick out the individual cobbles so they'll really show up on the photos. What's the thrill for you of finding something?
Oh, it fills in a lot of the gaps that history leaves behind.
You dig holes to fill in the gaps?
Yeah.
That works.
Scarlett's using a trowel with a blade not much larger than your thumb. She's on her haunches in the spot where the blacksmiths, rope makers, carpenters and shipwrights helped build Bristol's fame.
I've got some timber here, so that's very soft, and the road actually went over it, so you have to be quite careful. We've got a hard surface and then a very soft one underneath it.
And you've got a tiny bit of pottery here.
Yeah, here I have just a small bit. And over here, just behind this wall, we've had a lot. I've had buckets full, actually, over here. Yeah.
Now, we're all here excited by what's been going on in Richard III's car park. Do you get a buzz out of finding a bit of old pot?
Oh, definitely. I mean, every day's an adventure and a puzzle to work out, you know. You never know what you're going to find. Maybe a king, maybe a bit of pot or an old bit of wood. You never know. To us, it's all exciting.
Well, Scarlett, thank you very much.
All right, nice to meet you.
All right, leave you to it.
Thank you.
One of the best ways I've heard of explaining the thrill of archaeology. Well, with thanks to Tim Longman and his team, who are hiring if you're in the area and you're in the business, and if you're listening at St Teresa's, please come out on all BH recordings until you go to secondary school. Well, listening, Nick Thorpe, Head of Archaeology at the University of Winchester. Hello, Nick.
Hello there.
Is your trowel thumb twitching listening to that?
It is indeed, yes.
Good. And Gillian Haval is author and archaeologist and is also known as... Gillian, what's your nickname?
The Muddy Archaeologist.
The Muddy Archaeologist. These are great salad days for archaeologists. Do you want to start by slapping your colleagues in Leicester on the back with a muddy hand, Gillian?
Oh, definitely. A little bit of envy. We don't all find kings under car parks, and usually it's a bit of pot and a bit of something else, but it's all a piece of history. It's fantastic because it's just created Richard III fever.
Do you agree with Scarlett there, saying that if, in a certain way, a bit of pot can be a king?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, it's when you look at, say, let's go look at the Staffordshire hoard, you know, that great gold stuff, and everybody's saying it's treasure and it's fantastic, but its real treasure is what it tells us about the history. It changed the way we saw things, and perhaps Richard III will change the way we see himself. Mm. But a piece of pot can tell us that somebody of a certain era was in that area or whatever.
Nick, is that the heart of it? You archaeologists see yourself as the senior service, and all those hapless historians come along and give their human interpretation. But you deal in something rather more what we call meat and potatoes.
Well, I mean, often we're looking at the everyday part of ancient life, and therefore we are, as and it said in the earlier interview, filling in the gaps. I mean, it's like an ongoing, never-ending detective story, really, archaeology.
What of the pressure on funding? We're in a triple dip risk to our economy. It's austerity Britain. The dig I just visited was funded thanks to the planning rules. If you're going to put up a new building in a car park, you have to help fund the digging. But I believe that because of what's happened in the economy, Nick, we have lost jobs in archaeology.
Yes, that's certainly been true. I mean, the jobs which depend on funding from developers will go up and down depending on the state of the economy generally.
But I told you there that, in fact, Tim Longman and his team are hiring. Do we think post-Richard III, you know, the second life he's had, that we'll see more collaboration, Gillian, between... say, amateur archaeologists and professional teams?
Oh, definitely. There's a thing called community archaeology. So although you have your professional groups, you also have groups of amateurs who are steered by professionals, and it's very much the way forward when you haven't got a great deal of money, because you might get a Heritage Lottery Fund grant, and that will enable all sorts of people from all sorts of professions and all sorts of interests to come in and not just have a go, but to really make a difference. What they find can change the way that we see things.
Mm, and that's certainly what's a hope for in this discovery. Nick, what are you digging at the moment?
Well, our main major project in Winchester is the excavation of a medieval leper hospital, which we're doing as a student project, but also with local volunteers as well. And the idea of that is to try to get an idea by looking at the skeletons, the buildings, the rubbish pits, and all the relevant evidence from the site of how it was actually like to be a leper in medieval England.
And, you know, that entered the language. Was there evidence that other pariahs were treated as lepers even if they did not have the disease?
Well, it seems quite clear that there was a lot of false diagnosis at the time, and unfortunately it was a one-way ticket. Once you went into the leper hospital, that was it, you were there for life. So there undoubtedly were some unfortunate people who were stuck even though they didn't need to be. But, I mean, as far as we can see, many of the people there were fairly well treated. They had a good diet. They had access to imported goods and so on. And they were well treated in death as well, buried in a proper, respectful manner. One of the burials we found, indeed, was of a pilgrim, somebody who'd been all the way to Santiago de Compostela in Spain. Mm. So must have been a wealthy and important individual, but came back and ended up being buried in our leper hospital.
You see, Gillian, as a layman, I listened to that, and I think that that conflicts with what I thought of medieval England in this case, that there was compassion to social outcasts at this time. Does it surprise you as a fellow expert of Nick's?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. History's often simplified and it's often far, far more complex, and people are more complex, and that's what we're digging about. We're digging about people and their lives, how they lived, how people interacted with each other. It is far, far more complex and yet often much more human, really.
But then, we're all knocking historians. If I got three archaeologists in a trench and said, what does this mean? Would you
You'd
all
have
be...
six opinions, basically.
So you're just as bad, are you? Kind of, it's not clear, really.
It's not. There's loads of science which can give us facts and dates, but even the carbon dating will give you three options and you have to choose which one is the most appropriate or the most likely. So it's all about using your interpretation skills, your imagination, dare I say it, to a certain extent, and putting the facts together and working out which is the best working theory.
OK, well, I'll give you a fantasy dig anywhere in the UK. Nick, you go first, and then to you, Gillian.
OK.
What do you think is out there that should be found?
Well, I think one of the most extraordinary areas in terms of British archaeology is the Orkney Islands, where I was been lucky enough to work in the past. And the remarkable thing there is you have extremely good survival of houses, so getting a really good idea of how people lived their lives as old as something like 3,500 BC, all the way up to the medieval period. So I'd love to work there again, certainly.
Gillian?
Yes, well, I'm a classical historian, so anything that's Roman, but I'm going to put myself on a limb and say that the most important archaeology is the stuff that makes people in the street see their own community differently.
Okay.
So stuff that's down at the end of the road and they go, gosh, I'd never thought that I'm walking in the same space as the ancestors.
That's like my Bristol car park that I was
in.
Well,
exactly.
Now, as a special treat for you, we would normally say goodbye to you here, but we have tried to imagine how Richard III would sound. Would you like to join us listening to that?
Most certainly.
Right, that's good. Right answer, Gillian. Nick, are you pushing off or will you stay?
I'm keen to hear.
Well, based on the written clues, the University of Leicester's deduced he had the accent of the West Midlands, so BH is the only news programme to have turned to Noddy Holder, Slade frontman and proud son of Walsall.
Sir, I say, I pray you that ye fail me not at this time in my great need. As ye will that I show you my good lordship in that matter that ye labour to me for.
Gillian, again, I'm looking for the right answer here. Do you want to hear more?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Because that was a note written in his own hand. But, Nick, I know you'll be more familiar with him from Shakespeare's pen. Noddy?
Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York. And all the clouds that lord upon our house, in the deep bosom of the ocean bedded, now are the brows bound with victorious wreaths.
Well, what a way to go. It is. You started with happiness and we'll end with your giggling, both of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gillian Haval there and Nick Thorpe, live archaeologists, and thanks to Noddy Holder. Listening is Duncan Myers, who says that enjoying discussing archaeology on the radio, but he's trying to get the York-Leicester rivalry going. Don't forget that York is the best centre for archaeology in the UK today, and the Dig. So there's more rivalry there. And Elizabeth Kershaw, who's 58, has been recommended to us as the listener of the morning by her son, Clement. Now, around this time last week, Sandy Toksvig took our Radio 4 listenership test. She showed off an encyclopedic knowledge of the shipping forecast and confessed she loved those unexpected programmes you hear on the radio.
I think the thing that characterises me most is that when I go away on holiday, if I get back in the car and I put Radio 4 on and I hear somebody like Peter Donaldson say, and now the history of the duffel coat in six parts. And then you think, oh, I'm home now. That's good.
I'm already looking for mid-length.
Yeah, part four, the toggle.
And then she vanished in a Danish puff. But listening was Alistair Graham, who emailed saying Sandy Toksvig must have missed the programme broadcast some 15 years ago on exactly this topic. I recall driving overnight from London to Edinburgh and listening to this on the radio whilst in the wilder parts of Northumberland. A Radio 4 programme about the duffel coat, and we missed it.
Duffel was a town, a small textile town in Belgium, producing a particular type of cloth, and this goes back to the Middle Ages. And it was a hard-wearing cloth that was worn by the local people who worked on the waterways and in the fields and so on.
And we also heard in that programme back then from the highly decorated retired naval commander Sir Robert Atkinson on duffels.
That was a standard rig, the duffel coat. After the war, as many people as possible kept the duffel coats. And I do believe that at the naval stores, they would sell you a coat for £1 or something.
Well, we rang the home of Sir Robert Atkinson to find he's in hale and hearty health. So there's another version of duffel love that you weren't expecting to hear. I have more for you at this time. Now, reviewing the Sundays for us this morning are Michael Portillo, the journalist, broadcaster and former Conservative Party politician. Would you like a glass of water, Mike?
I'm absolutely fine. Thank you. Good morning.
Michael's hits include Dinner with Portillo and Great British Railway Journeys. Heather Bell is returning to Ambridge tonight and to a character she first played more than 30 years ago. She will reprise the role of Clary Grundy, the long-suffering wife of Ed.
Your cocoa's the one nearest on the tray, Joe.
Oh, yeah.
That's yours with the spoon in it.
Tart.
With a country and western band in the background. And Charles Swammerer Smith is chief executive of the Royal Academy of Arts, British art historian and former director of the National Portrait Gallery. Also, he had a stint as the director of the National Gallery and former president of the Museums Association. Last year, David Hockney created a number of large-scale landscapes, especially for the Royal Academy.
They came to me and asked me if I wanted to do this, and I pointed out, well, only the Royal Academy could do that.
Praise from Hockney. You wouldn't want it the other way around, I suspect. Heather, welcome. Welcome
Thank
to
you.
The radio.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Where would you like to start?
Well, my favourite piece of today, I'd like to, if I may, just read the very first paragraph of
I'd
it.
I'd love it.
The headline is, it's from the Mail on Sunday, a 100-year wait, but Chelsea Flower Show finally says, welcome Gnome. It is a controversial and flagrant display of discrimination that has plagued one of Britain's most august institutions for decades. But now, the 208-year-old Royal Horticultural Society has caved in to public pressure and finally agreed to lift its ban on garden gnomes at the Chelsea Flower Show. Officials had previously been accused of taking a snobbish attitude to the ornaments, which many deride as tacky. But this year, on the 100th anniversary of the show, gnomes are not only to be allowed into the grounds, but will be positively celebrated. Celebrities will be invited to decorate the diminutive gentlemen, and a parade of 150 of them will be lined up for official inspection by the Queen.
Heather continues on Radio 4 Extra. Heather, what's your view on this? Are you a gardener?
A bit, yes. I try to be. Yes, I've got a very, very small garden, but I'm very interested in it.
Where do you stand on garden gnomes?
Well, I don't have one at the moment, but never say never.
David Cameron surely will introduce legislation shortly legalising the marriage of gnomes. And it's a very important progressive piece of legislation which will position the Conservative Party well in the centre ground.
I don't have gnomes.
You don't have gnomes. Are you gnomist? I mean, there you are at the Royal Academy, very highfalutin, with a grand...
No,
cut.
We're very populist, very democratic. We got 600,000 people to Hockney and we'll probably get 400,000 to Manet. So
that's very, very... That's good.
Artistic gnomes we like.
Are you pleased, Heather, with the gnome?
Am I pleased with the gnome? Yeah, I'm very... I hope I will be able to go and see this exhibition and of gnomes.
Michael Portillo, where would you begin?
It was just mentioned in the news, actually. Of course, the government is proposing that elderly people who need to acquire care or go into care should have to pay no more than £75,000 on their care before the state steps in and takes over the subsidy. Now, I think that this has nothing to do with the care of the elderly. What this is really about is safeguarding the inheritance that otherwise would be lost if an elderly person sold his or her house. That money would not be available to go down to the next generation. Very often here we're talking about middle-class people whose children, of course, are well grown up and probably quite well established. And I think, in a way, there is a hint that the government understands perfectly well that it's doing, because it's saying that this move is going to be financed by freezing the threshold on inheritance tax. So, you know, there is the clue that the people who are being saved, they're going to get their legacies intact, are going to pay for it by having more inheritance tax.
Well, where are the keen on enabling people to leave legacies to the Royal Academy? So I'd rather not have more tax on legacy.
But do you feel you understand as an individual what your bill will be should you need care? Because we can tell people very well what the government might say tomorrow, but we can't say to listeners what their bill will be. It's not very... That's the main meat and potatoes.
It can be huge, can't it? Because a lot of the expenses are right at the end of people's lives.
Yes, but the extraordinary thing is we're all told that we should save for a rainy day, but when the rainy day comes, we're then told that we shouldn't use our savings, we should expect the state to step in and do that. And, you know, we're also being told that we're in a period of austerity. We've got to shrink the size of the welfare state. Here is the government devising very cleverly a way of extending the welfare state to the upper middle classes.
I feel there will be more commentary about this all for the next 24 hours or so. So thank you for raising that. That's the Observer front page. Charles Swanrose-Smith, you're the first of your own choices this morning.
Well, the story which caught my eye is a big double-page spread in the Sunday Telegraph called Mr. Blair and the Oligarch, which is about Victor Pinchuk, who's a great collector of art. And I suppose, obviously, at the Academy, I'm interested in this huge number of very wealthy Russians who live in London. I was told yesterday by somebody who set up an art gallery for them in Cork Street that there are 500,000 Russians resident in London now. But they're not very well known. One of them who is well known, at least vicariously, is this man Victor Pinchuk, who has an art centre in Ukraine, in Kiev, and is a great collector of Damien Hirst, and he had an exhibition of Anthony Gormley. But I'm not somebody who knows very much about him. You can probably get all this information by Googling on the internet, but I found it enormously helpful to have it all laid out in a double-page spread.
And it's a profile, and it mentions that he funds Tony Blair's Faith Foundation, I think is what it is.
That's correct. He's given 500,000, but that's chicken feed compared to the £80 million he spent on the house in Kensington.
And he has a lovely sheep in formaldehyde, by the look of it.
Yep, that's the Damien Hirst.
How much is a sheep in formaldehyde these days?
It's probably... Well, I'm not sure how Damien Hirst is doing since the big sale at Sotheby's on the day the collapse of the economy came, but it's still worth a fair amount of money.
A fair amount. Heather, yes. Where would you turn next?
Well, there's a wonderful interview in The Observer of Emmanuelle Rivard, who is an 85-year-old actress who found work after many years of not working. she actually was a brilliant star, and she was the star of Hiroshima Mon Amour, which we were all encouraged to go and see when we were at school, and an unforgettable performance in Amour, just brilliant.
Now, I think you're talking about the new film there.
I am, yes.
And so what age is she now, and how is she being reviewed?
She's now 85, and she says that Michael Haneke, who was the director, had seen Hiroshima Mon Amour, and he wanted to see me again after all these years. I was perhaps in his head, she says.
It's Sunset Boulevard with knobs on, isn't it? Absolutely. But it gives such hope to all of us, doesn't it? I'm myself hoping to make a comeback at around that age.
Yes.
But is it something you that is true that there are roles for older women now? I think we're always told that that's difficult.
I very much hope that there are, and that there will continue to be. If you look at that film that Dustin Hoffman made, Quartet, there was a lot of speculation about how there will be a lot more work for elderly actors and actresses from now on, so let's hope
She's got a wonderful face, unfacelifted. It
yes.
shows how it seldom one sees in the newspapers those sorts of elderly wrinkled faces. Actually, in The Observer, she's been given a slightly younger photograph, but there was one in the paper earlier in the week which showed her as she probably is at 85.
Yeah.
In her full glory.
Yes.
Emmanuel Riva, thank you very much. Michael, you were looking at the Andrew Rawnsley column in The Observer, and it's telling us it's too early to write off Labour in Eastleigh.
Yes, and the Eastleigh by-election, which is being held with obscene haste, is a difficult one to call, because on the face of it, nobody can win it. It would be impossible, surely, for the Liberal Democrats to win this by-election, given the circumstances in which it was caused and given that the Liberal Democrats are very low in the polls. It couldn't possibly be won by the Conservatives, surely, because no sitting Conservative Prime Minister has won a by-election since 1982. I mean, sitting Conservative governments simply don't. Labour can't win it because they only got 8% of the vote last time. Or can they? If you take the position that neither Conservatives nor the Liberal Democrats can win it, then after a while you begin to think that maybe Labour could. And it turns out that actually in the 1994 Eastleigh by-election, Labour came quite a decent second, beating the Conservatives. So it's a very exciting by-election, a lot of dynamism. I think a lot will change as it goes along.
And Andrew Rawnsley makes the point, Labour, if they fight and lose, don't lose as much as the other two parties when they fight and lose.
No, of course. I mean, Nick Clegg is trying to prove that the Liberal Democrats are not as damaged as the polls claim, and the Conservatives are trying to prove that they can take lots of Liberal Democrat seats at the next election.
But elsewhere in The Observer, I thought there was a rather good description of what the voters in Eastleigh actually think about Chris Huhne. And I thought they were surprisingly sympathetic to him, given the absolute acres of incredibly hostile press all through the last fortnight. Suddenly, you talk to the constituents in Eastleigh and they say he was quite a conscientious, hardworking and intelligent MP, and I wish there were more like it.
My experience of by-elections is that if they're caused unnecessarily, the party that caused them cannot win. There has to be a body for a by-election, for people to accept a by-election. Someone has to have died.
The Conservative candidate is extremely right-wing, isn't she?
Well, the Conservative candidate is extremely controversial, and that's one of the factors that will inject dynamism into what happens.
And Norman Smith will be dealing with this at lunchtime. But you want to talk to us more about Chris Huhne, Charles Swammer-Smith. You've turned to the diary in The Independent on Sunday.
Well, yes, I found it interesting. Most of the Chris Huhne and Vicky Price stuff is once read it by now. And it's this thing where the Sunday papers just tell one everything once already read through the course of the week. But I picked up this small piece in the diary of the Independent of Sunday, which I hadn't seen elsewhere, that Chris Huhne's father had actually made a lot of money through setting up a company called Traffic Safety Systems in 1996. So poor guy, as he's speeding down the M11, it's his father's safety camera which catches him on film.
And before I move on, you mentioned voters in Eastleigh being more sympathetic than you thought when you read the coverage. Are you someone who is sympathetic to this man?
I would imagine that everybody, as they've watched this Greek tragedy play out over the course of the last week for both of them, at this stage, people must begin to feel some sort of sympathy for the two of them.
OK, thank you very much. And to you, Heather, we're now going to go into a David Mitchell review in The Observer about Leicester and Richard III.
Yes, and what he says is, what Leicester needs to do now is launch a Richard III theme park. Well, you know how naughty he is and how brilliant he is. He then goes on to talk about various places in the country where dreadful historical events have taken place, and he talks about theme parks for many of them, and the one that interests me is the Highland Clearances Designer Village, where he says, maybe in time, what once stood for the suffering of an entire nation will come to mean nothing more woeful than heavily reduced designer shoes.
Things have already gone rather badly wrong in this field, because there's an interpretation centre at Bosworth for the battle, and it's about 2 miles in the wrong place. It was thought that the battle occurred on the hill, and actually it occurred in a swamp.
Oh.
And so the interpretation centre offers, you know, quite a good view on a clear day of a distant battlefield, but it is actually in the wrong place.
Actually, talking about knowledge of British history, I thought one of the odder pieces in the paper was about the way the new high-speed train is going to go across the Battle of Edgecote. I sort of looked at it several times, thought, is this a misprint for the Battle of Edgehill? Even my knowledge of British history is not such that I greatly lament the destruction of the battlefield of Edgecote.
But it will be enhanced by a railway line.
That is the view of people who love railways, isn't it? And not the view of people who have them at the end of the garden, perhaps. Now, Michael Patillo, do move us along. We're going to talk about gay marriage. I thought we've talked about gay marriage. Are we talking about gay marriage endlessly now? Well, Sunday Telegraph.
No, I wanted to talk particularly about the House of Lords, because in the Sunday Telegraph there's a story, Tory rebels may scupper gay marriage bill in the House of Lords. And then there are lots of people who used to be in the House of Commons when I was there, saying that they're going to battle against it. Well, I was just thinking, you see, it's 100 years ago since there was an epic battle between the House of Lords and the government of the day, which was a Liberal government, and that led to the Parliament Act, I think of 1911, which restricted the power of the House of Lords to one in which they could only delay legislation. And that was after a really clear-cut case where the government had passed its budget in the House of Commons, and the House of Lords scuppered Lloyd George's budget. Now, I think this is also a pretty clear case. I mean, the House of Commons voted the other day, I think, by 400 votes to 175 for gay marriage. And so the House of Lords, I think, really is out of its constitutional depth if it thinks it's going to...
But they're surely allowed to amend legislation, aren't they? I mean, I know they're not allowed to block it absolutely constitutionally, which is correct, but they do have a corrective aspect to legislation, so presumably it will be fought through
in this lot. In this particular case, I think what the House of Lords can do is have a very erudite debate. And I mean that. I mean, you know, there will be
bishops will speak.
Well, and also people like Lord Lawson, who's come out here as being opposed to what's being proposed. There will be a very high quality debate. But in the end of it, the principle has been established by the House of Commons, and the House of Lords must bend the knee.
And let's turn to you, Charles. You're going to tell us about the Kraftwerk concert that you went to, reflected in The Observer, and how Kraftwerk are back.
Yeah, I mean, I not surprisingly turned immediately to the reviews of the Kraftwerk concert because I was there last night. I was one of the relatively small number of people who managed to get a ticket to it because all the computers crash within 2 minutes.
Oh, so you're not boasting, isn't that? You're saying you're fortunate.
I'm slightly boasting about the fact that I had the great pleasure and privilege of sitting in the Turbine Hall at Tate last night and seeing this rather amazing performance by a band who were said to be big in the 70s, although I don't remember them. Michael may have been better on pop at that time, but they've kind of made this huge, great comeback, and they've worn very well, and they do this great light show, and I thought it was fantastically impressive.
Kraftwerk. And that took us all by surprise that you were giving them a vote of confidence, but thank you for doing so. Heather, I'm just going to tell you that there's not much more time for review, but there's a quiz question from an Archers listener, Guy Morgan. You don't have to answer it. You can just go, ha, ha, and we'll assume you know. Please ask Heather if her husband's gnomes will feature at Chelsea. That's Clary's husband's, because one of Eddie's businesses involved casting somewhat dubious garden ornaments. And remember, take refuge in a nice theatrical laugh if you don't know the answer.
Well, I do hope they will be, and I do hope that Eddie and I will be present to see them.
All right, well, look, thank you very much indeed. It's a plot spoiler there in the life of the gnome. But Heather Bell, who returns to Ambridge tonight, thank you for gracing the BH Bonkat.
Thank you, great fun.
Michael Portillo, thank you for coming back. And Charles Swarmer-Smith, Kraftwerk fan, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
It's 52 minutes past nine. Tomorrow brings the 50th anniversary of the death of the poet Sylvia Plath. In the autumn of 1962, her marriage with the fellow poet Ted Hughes had disintegrated and she moved to a flat in London with her two children. What followed was one of the coldest winters on record and the creation of some of the most widely read poems of Plath's career. We've gathered some recordings of her own readings and the recollections of two friends, Gillian Becker and Al Alvarez, to describe her last winter.
Now it's Siberia.
The snow is very thick on the ground and is freezing cold.
worse for 82 years more to come.
Nightmare stuff. And it wouldn't stop.
Britain is snowed to a standstill.
Everything went on and on and on.
It's Britain's most costly winter.
London in those days was really quite a difficult world to be in.
For London, it was the coldest January since records were first kept in 1841. For Manchester, it was the coldest since...
The tongues of hell are dull. Dull as the triple tongues of dull, fat Cerberus who wheezes at the gate.
The last winter was obviously hell. As a, you know, real hell. But all the good poems in Ariel are last winter poems. The stuff she did in that last year was really quite extraordinary, taking poetry to places it had never been.
We had mutual friends and we were introduced and we quickly became friends. But I met her only after her marriage had broken up. She was wrecked with misery.
She left Ted, or rather, Ted left her, rather. And before that, she and Ted had got together and talked about poetry. She kind of sought me out because I was part of that world. And she desperately needed someone to talk to, you know. That. So we talked, God knows.
We would sit in cafes and talk, or in my house or in her flat and talk. But all the time I was aware of her deep misery, her grief.
She turned up at my place, theoretically wanting to show me some poems she'd written. Beyond the theory, well, we had a kind of very, very, very brief, what would you call it, engagement. She and I got together, and then that was it, you know, that I had this feeling probably quite foolishly that I don't like messing around with in other people's marriages.
She phoned me up and said, can I come with the children? I said, yes, of course. And then Sylvia stayed with me until that was right up to the Sunday night, the night before she died, she stayed with us.
The idea that he was screwing around, that was something she really couldn't take at that point. It drove her crazy.
She wouldn't let me go when I said, do you want to sleep now? I'll go to bed. She said, no, stay with me, stay with me. And she rambled. She complained about Ted and the woman he'd left her for, Asya. She told me that he'd taken her to Spain. And then she said, I wish I could get away into the sun with the children. You know, it was the coldest winter on record for many, many years. Thick snow on the ground. And she said, I wish I could get into the sun.
Oh, my God, what am I, that these late mouths should cry open in a forest of frost, in a dawn of cornflowers?
In the morning, I went to see that she took her wake-up pills. She ate a good breakfast, she played with the children. Later on, we all had lunch, and almost suddenly, she said, I must go home now. I tried several times to say, are you sure this is a time you want to go home? Wouldn't you rather stay at least a few more days? No, she insisted.
Stasis in darkness, then the substanceless blue pour of tor and distances. God's lioness,
how one we grow. Pivot of heels and knees, the furrow splits and passes. Sister to the brown arc of the neck I cannot catch.
Late in the afternoon, she got into my husband's car, which was an old London taxi cab. They drove off, and finally he stopped at a light and realised, heard, that she was sobbing. So he pulled up. She was weeping copiously, and he said, Sylvia, don't go home. Come back. Gillian wants you to come back. I want you to come back. She said, no, 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 take me home, take me home. In the morning, round about 8 o'clock, the phone rang, and it was Dr. Horder with the news that Sylvia had gassed herself and was dead.
I remember somebody calling me, some rather ghastly guy, calling me and saying, I thought I should tell you, Sylvia's committed suicide. It was horrible.
You do not do, you do not do, any more black shoe in which I have lived like a foot for 30 years, poor and white, barely daring to breathe or hachoo. Daddy, I have had to kill you.
She's so good, isn't she? She really meant it, too. It was all right on the edge there. Listening to her read Daddy, there's no nonsense about that, is it? This is someone who is really firmly alive.
She said the blood jet is poetry. She wrote that marvellous poetry out of that pitch of excitement and I suppose terror too, great grief. And the world is the beneficiary of it.
Gillian Becker and Al Alvarez there, with thanks to them. For more on Sylvia Plath, tune in to Witness on the World Service tomorrow, where you'll hear an in-depth account of that final winter. The weather, cold with rain for much of the UK, except for the far southeast of England and the far north of Scotland. During the day, there will be snow in the north of England, south of Scotland and Grampians. Later, snow will move into Kent, the London area, the Midlands and the Highlands. Congratulations to Sheila Morby from Worcester, correctly guessing. Our audio news quiz referred to the building of the new Durham police station that was halted after a colony of great crested newts was discovered on the site. The producers were Thomas Edgington, Stephanie Cummings and Xavier Zapata. The editor was Amanda Lewis. From our lot to yours, thanks for listening and goodbye.